The Natural Nurse with Ellen Kamai and Dr. Z, Mondays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Joining us right here on Progressive Radio Network. That's progressiveradionetwork.com, where you can hear all of our shows from The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. That's Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, and Dr. Eugene Zamperone, as we bring you information in natural medicine every week, 1 p.m., right here on Progressive Radio Network. And today, I am very happy to have as my guest Mr. Mark Blumenthal. Mark is the founder and executive director of the American Botanical Council and the leading independent nonprofit organization dedicated to disseminating accurate, reliable, and responsible information on herbs and medicinal plants. He is also the editor, publisher of Herbalgram, a magazine I get every month, an international peer-reviewed quarterly journal. For 6 years, he was an adjunct associate professor of medical chemistry at the University of Texas at Austin College of Pharmacy, teaching the course Herbs and Phytomedicine in Today's Pharmacy. And Mark is involved in every aspect of herbal medicine and a real leader in the herbal community in the United States and around the world. Thank you so much for joining us today, Mark.
Well, hello, Ellen, and thanks for having me on. I'm grateful for being included.
Well, you know, you have been a real leader in the herbal movement for so long, and I guess we must have met in the late 1970s or so, and you were already deeply involved in herbal medicine.
Yeah, I had an herb company back then. I was in the middle, late 70s until the middle 80s. I had a wholesale herb business. I was selling herbal extracts, Chinese herbs, ginseng, incense, and herbal cosmetics and spices, and, you know, from 1 pound to 100 pounds to various health food stores, small manufacturers, food co-ops. Here in Austin, Texas, and around the South and Midwest and Southwest, and eventually got out of the business of herbs and focus more on the educational side and the advocacy for science, education based on science, more research, increased quality control and ethics in the herbal community and herbal industry, etc. And so back in 1988, I started the American Botanical Council as a nonprofit organization to take the magazine, which was a newsletter back then, Herbalgram, from 1983 to 1988, was a newsletter that I published for some other herbal organizations in the industry that I had helped co-found and helped start. But I kind of went off on my own, so to speak, direction, separate from industry, back in 88, in order to take Herbalgram from this newsletter format to the four-color magazine / journal, peer-reviewed publication that it is today. Some people call it like the Scientific American of Herbs because it's colorful, it's engaging, but it's all referenced and it's all checked out by experts knowledgeable in the various disciplines and herbal medicine and science. So it's been a long ride, it's been a lot of fun, and it's nowhere near over.
Oh no, and you can see the change and expansion in the herbal industry. It's almost like a double-edged sword. Back in the day, there was a real separation between those people who used herbal medicine and those people who did not. So back then, I don't think something like herb-drug interactions was as worrisome. But as the popularity of herbal medicine has increased so much, and your organization does a lot of work tracking that with accurate information, the other edge of that is that there's more people that might be experiencing something like herb-drug interactions because now they're using both.
Yeah, you've got about 30 or 36%, depending on which, or 40%, depending on which statistical surveys you look at, of adult Americans using herbs. I mean, over 50% or up to 70% of seniors, 50% of adults and 70% of seniors use some kind of dietary supplement, but not all of them are herbal dietary supplements. So somewhere, since about most of the population is taking some kind of over-the-counter and or prescription medication, you're going to have obviously an overlap of people taking both dietary supplements, including herbal dietary supplements, with conventional pharmaceutical medicines, whether they be prescription or non-prescription. So at least statistically, it is not a stretch to hypothesize that there's going to be some form or some increase in the potential herb-drug interactions experienced by people in the population. Curiously, we're not seeing a whole lot of reports coming in of adverse reactions that based on an herb-drug interaction that are considered serious. There are potential for herb-drug interactions, but interestingly, a 2008 study published by the Mayo Clinic, where they looked at 1,700 of their patients that were reportedly using herbs, they found a subset of those patients that had been using herbs that were for cardiovascular purposes or for a variety of items for reasons, and they were also using some kind of prescription pharmaceutical drug. There was no clinically significant adverse interaction recorded in any of those patients, according to the patient's records or the doctor's reports or the patient's own recollection. So interestingly, and this is one of the best pieces of literature we have so far in the modern medical literature, a Mayo Clinic report that patients did not experience a negative or an adverse herb-drug interaction. Does that mean that herb-drug interactions don't happen? Of course not. Does that mean that herb-drug interactions can't be or are not serious? Of course not. There are potential serious interactions. The one herb that comes to mind most frequently among herb experts and a growing body of health professionals is St. John's wort, which has been shown to be safe and effective for helping to treat the symptoms associated with mild to moderate depressive states. However, St. John's wort is known to interact with approximately 50% of the pharmaceutical drugs that are currently available to consumers and patients. And so anyone who is taking a prescription or pharmaceutical drug and is thinking about taking St. John's wort for whatever reason should check with their pharmacist first before taking St. John's wort, because what it can do is actually it induces an enzyme system that will break down that levels of the drug in the bloodstream and therefore cause the drug to have a lower level of concentration and therefore a lower level of activity, so often rendering it actually ineffective. So you don't want to do that, obviously. So you don't want to interact. You don't want to have your St. John's wort basically lower or negate or nullify the effectiveness of your pharmaceutical drug. And might I add also, Ellen, as you know, and as probably many of your listeners know because they're probably quite savvy, grapefruit juice and grapefruit has just the opposite effect of St. John's wort. Grapefruit actually lowers the level and the activity of these enzymes in the gut and the liver that break down various drugs. So what happens is they actually, by lowering the level of those enzymes, you actually have a higher concentration of some drugs in the bloodstream, thereby increasing their activity. So you do not want to take grapefruit or drink grapefruit juice at breakfast. If you're taking prescription drugs, you should wait at least 30 minutes or an hour before or after taking drugs before you take grapefruit.
Yes, and all these things are information that people, I would say herbalgram.org is the best place to go. Is that the best place to find all the information about the American Botanical Council?
Right. As an independent nonprofit science-based organization, the American Botanical Council's website, herbalgram.org, which is the name of our journal and magazine, Herbalgram, has all kinds of information, six different databases, which includes all the back issues of Herbalgram, over 4,500 or close to 5,000 herb clip summaries of clinical and scientific literature on herbs, these two-page summaries. The first and second books that we published on the German Commission e-monographs, basically how the German government evaluated the safety and benefits 380 different herbs and herb combinations sold in German pharmacies as medicines, and how the government evaluated the safety and the benefits of those herbs. That's all been translated and databased by ABC, and it's available on our website, and other databases and other information as well. About 20% of the information in our website, and we have over 90,000, I think, pages of content, about 20% or so is actually freely available to the public without any membership. We are an independent nonprofit. We're a member-based organization, so our membership starts at $50 and go up, depending on what level is appropriate. At the $100 level, the academic level, you get complete access to everything on the site. At $50, you get lots of information, plus the magazine four times a year, plus the Herbal eGram electronic newsletter 12 times a year, plus member updates, media advisories, and all kinds of information. So we are a treasure trove of herbal information that's accurate, reliable, responsible, science-based, peer-reviewed, non-commercial, etc., and we're here to help improve and expand the public's awareness of the responsible use of herbs as part of their self-care and getting them, you know, integrated more into healthcare.
Well, for me, as a healthcare professional for so many years, as well as a professor, and I teach herbal medicine to physicians at Stony Brook University and in a course in herbal pharmacology, I give herbalgram.org as the go-to place, and I actually use several of your books as textbooks, although they're easy enough to use even for an individual who's interested, but they are referenced well enough to use as a textbook. And that includes the ABC Clinical Guide to Herbs, which I think is a must-have book for anyone interested in herbal medicine, and of course the German Commission E and the expanded German Commission E, which is more of a European-based explanation of the use of herbal medicine.
Right, and Ellen, I want to thank you for being so a long-term loyal supporter of ABC. I know it's not about ABC per se or me. It's really about the product of what we put out. We put out information that health professionals can't, like yourself, as a registered nurse, can trust. Information that is reliable, authoritative, responsible. You know, we believe, you know, there's millions of people out there that are self-medicating with herbs. Some people get information from healthcare practitioners, herbalists, acupuncturists, naturopaths, physicians, pharmacists, and others who are knowledgeable about herbs. But a lot of people self-medicate based on their own information wherever they get it. And we believe at ABC that self-medication requires self-education. You need to educate yourself if you're going to start using these products, not because they're unsafe or not because you put yourself at risk, but because it just makes sense to be responsible and use them responsibly. Some people can have an adverse effect or an adverse reaction to an herbal product, especially if they're a nursing or pregnant mother, if they're diabetic or have heart disease or high blood pressure, etc. There are certain herbs that may be contraindicated for some of these kinds of conditions, and people need to use these herbs responsibly. They do have pharmacological action. That's why we take them. We take them because we know they work. They work because they affect the pharmacology or the physiology of the body, and because of that, there are times when it may not be appropriate for us to use them, so we have to use them intelligently, accurately, and responsibly. And we, as a nonprofit organization, try to put that information out there. By the way, not necessarily as self-medication guides. We're not necessarily telling you to go do this. We're just providing information for people so they can help improve the quality of their choices.
And it's really well presented. Now, you also keep up on, you know, basically the whole political agenda. For instance, I know you wrote a response to an article we were talking earlier about herb-drug interactions, and there was one published February 2nd, 2010, in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. And whenever I see a report in the mainstream news media about anything having to do with herbal medicine, my first stop is herbalgram.org, and I'm always looking for your response because media contacts me for responses, and I'll always refer them to your response because it's so well put together. What did your organization have to say about that study that came out in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology Journal?
Let me just give your listeners a background, first of all, and thank you for bringing that up. The Journal of the American College of Cardiology published in February of 2010, so it's a little over a year ago, what they considered to be like a review paper. It was supposed to be a a white paper on potential interactions among consumers and patients taking cardiovascular drugs, drugs that affect clotting, drugs for heart, etc., and how herbs might interact with these cardiovascular drugs. So let me just say at the beginning, it is possible for some herbal preparations to interact with cardiovascular drugs. So the thesis, the hypothesis, is absolutely correct. You can have a problem. People should know more about this. And this is would normally be a welcome contribution to the scientific and clinical literature. It would be a welcome contribution to the literature if the authors of the review knew what they were doing, if they had any prior expertise and knowledge about herbs whatsoever, if the editors and peer reviewers of the article were also knowledgeable in this area, and if the feedback and if the article were accurate, responsible, and reliable. None of this is true. The article is atrociously inadequate and inaccurate. It would receive a fire. Their journal received a firestorm of negative feedback and criticism and corrections, most of which they ignored. And did not retract the article, which they should have done, and then revise the article if need be, subject to further and more appropriate, knowledgeable peer review scrutiny, and then perhaps reposted the revised, corrected article, which they did not do. They posted a lame, long response by the defense by the authors, but the journal did not remove the original article, which is till today, 14 or 15 months later, still available in the journal, being cited frequently by various other authors, thereby repeating some of the atrocious, ridiculous, and in some cases inexcusable errors that should never have gone into the kind of paper, because this is like a consensus paper. This is like a paper from the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, should be viewed by cardiologists, other healthcare professionals, the media, and the general public, as well as regulators, as an authoritative, reliable document. But it is not. Let me give you some examples here.
Please do.
First of all, they never use Latin names anywhere in the document. Now, anybody knows that herbs have many common names, and even sometimes some herbs have more than one Latin or scientific name. So when somebody uses a common name of an herb, it could theoretically refer to more than one herb. So you need to put the scientific Latin binomial, the two name Latin name scientific notation, to ensure that the reader knows where to find accurate information on this botanical, how to look it up. They did not use any Latin names throughout. That's a big no-no in any kind of herbal literature. You have to use Latin names. In one of their table four, I think it is, they talk about herbs that can interfere with the digoxin assay and the activity of digoxin, which is the heart drug that's taken from foxglove leaf, which is a poisonous plant, but they use it as an effective medicine when properly controlled to dosage for weak heart, congestive heart failure. They put a Chan Su, the first item mentioned is a Chinese herb that they call the Chinese herb called Chan Su, could interfere with the heart drugs. We've never heard of Chan Su. We looked it up. You know what it is?
What?
Chan Su is the venom from the skin of a Chinese toad. First of all, it's not an herb. It's an animal. And I don't know how these guys... Remember in third grade we learned animal, vegetable, mineral in science or science class or something? We learned how to distinguish between the three types of material in the world, animal, vegetable, mineral. This animal product has no business being an article about herbs and herbal supplements and their potential interaction with drugs. It just doesn't make sense. These guys picked this up, the authors picked it up from an article published in a previous journal without critically reviewing or figuring out what it was. It doesn't belong there. Secondly, they put all kinds of information in this article that were basically not relevant to the herbal dietary supplements sold in North America. They said commonly used herbs, and they gave a big list of items, many of which are not commonly used herbs. Let me give you an example. Oleander. Oleander is a highly toxic...
It's very poisonous. We would never use it.
It's an ornamental plant. It's not a plant of commerce in the dietary supplement or herbal tea industry. Maybe there's some oleander in the homeopathic market where they dilute it beyond the chemical levels But you don't see oleander tea in the health food store or grocery store. You don't see oleander extract in the health food store or drugstore. It's absurd. These guys did not really know what they were doing. They were taking anything that looked or appeared to be like plant-oriented that may have an adverse effect with cardiovascular medicines, and they threw it on the table, and they made it look like it was authoritative. And one of the main authors was from the Mayo Clinic, which gave it some cachet and credibility. But it's absolutely irresponsible. What they did is they actually muddied the waters instead of clarifying these issues, doing a disservice to the healthcare community, a disservice to cardiology and to the American public. And the journal has reinforced the disservice by not pulling the article off the table, you know, which is what the normal, appropriate, ethical thing to do. So this is a form, if you will, of intellectual dishonesty. When you are confronted with information that overwhelmingly supports a thesis that's counter to your position, and you keep resisting without adequate defense, without adequate logic, that's a form of intellectual dishonesty. You mean they should not have published it, and they should have totally pulled it off and revised it if possible or corrected it for it to be available today. So this is the kind of stuff, unfortunately, you sometimes find in medical journals, and yet very few people are doing the kind of scrutiny that's necessary to try to keep these guys honest, and that's one of the things we do at the American Botanical Council.
Well, let's have a little possible explanation about why these things happen. I mean, if we look at who actually supports the publication of these journals, it's certainly mostly the pharmaceutical companies.
That's correct. If you look at the advertising, it's mostly pharmaceutical drug advertising or medical device. In the case of cardiology, there's probably a lot of medical devices as well. I've not looked at their journal to see what kind of advertising, if any, is there. And I frankly don't go there, really. And I understand what the implications are of your raising that point. Whether there's editorial bias that's for pharmaceuticals and against the dietary supplement industry and that kind of thing. That may or may not be the case with the editors of this journal. That may or may not be operative in this particular article, and I don't know. I don't have any information on that. But
well,
what
was their response to you when you made such a coherent case about
well, that's interesting.
Things that were missing?
We presented to them a letter signed by six or seven experts. Myself, I was one of them. Dr. Norman Farnsworth at the University of Illinois, who's one of the leading medicinal plant experts in all of North America and all of the world. Michael Balix in the New York Botanical Garden, who's a well-respected ethnobotanist. Mary Hardy is a very well-known and knowledgeable family practice medicine physician in Los Angeles who knows a lot about herbal medicine. Francis Brinker, who's the author of the fourth edition of the book called Herb-Drug Interactions, and who had co-authored an article at the Mayo Clinic that I mentioned earlier that found no interactions. By the way, that article wasn't referenced in this particular article that we're talking about now. Dr. Rick Kingston at the University of Mississauta, he is a doctor in pharmacy and an expert on pharmacovigilance, which is the study of adverse effects of drugs and herbs and dietary supplements. He runs one of the nation's largest adverse event reporting centers, Safety Call International. So what we did is we wrote a letter basically with people in the area of pharmacology, toxicology, herbal medicine, et cetera, who understood these issues. And yet the journal refused to publish our letter and refused, after repeated attempts to communicate with them, to pull the article. It did publish three small, short letters from various other people, and at the same time did publish a long, extensive attempt by the authors to try to justify their positions, but which were full of lots more holes. And so basically it's a very sad state of affairs when medical journal editors don't get humble, don't be honest and responsible, and do what's required by pulling an article down, fixing it if necessary according to what's appropriate, and then putting it back out. I mean, newspapers all the time and magazines all the time have to correct mistakes. In this case, this article had so many mistakes that it couldn't stand on its own two legs if the editors weren't propping it up. But it's just an unfortunate situation. And whether or not bias is in there, I prefer to say just ignorance. They just don't understand this area. And whether that's bias or not, I'll leave it up to somebody else to decide.
Well, and again, certainly in mainstream literature, unlike the case 20 or 30 years ago, there now is so many excellent studies substantiating the safety and efficacy of the use of herbal medicine. You referenced St. John's Wort before, and of course they actually have an article in the Cochrane Review, which is very well respected in terms of a study of many of the activities of St. John's Wort, when it's appropriate to use it, and as you said, possible interactions. So we're seeing more and more of that in the literature as well.
Yes, and one of that, and I wrote an editorial, an invited editorial in a medical journal called Alternative Therapies in Health and Medicine in March 2009, so just about 2 years ago, reviewing the data supportive of benefits for herbs as documented in meta-analyses and systematic reviews. And St. John's Wort was one of the examples that I used. Just to be clear, a meta-analysis and a systematic review are basically a process where one takes multiple clinical studies, 5, 10, 15, in the case of St. John's Wort, 29 clinical studies that met the criteria for inclusion. They may have looked at 85 studies on St. John's Wort, and only 29 met the inclusion criteria, you know, randomized, placebo-controlled, or reference-controlled, double-blind, et cetera. So what they do, they try to look at all the literature and collect all the literature on herb X to treat a symptom of Y or whatever, and then see which ones of those studies meet the criteria for a review, and then they pool all the data and then see which way the direction goes. Instead of looking at studies individually, they look at the study in a pooled concentration of all the data or aggregation. And more we are seeing that some of these systematic reviews or meta-analyses are actually supporting some and documenting some benefit of various herbs. And we just saw one on a systematic review on hibiscus tea, actually having a mild blood pressure lowering effect. We've seen one on garlic having a mild blood pressure lowering effect. We're seeing one on hawthorn that shows excellent support as an adjunct therapy for congestive heart failure, hawthorn leaf and flower extract. And more, we're seeing pooled analyses, these systematic reviews of multiple clinical trials supporting the safety and the overall benefits of various herbs and herb preparations. It's really interesting. And on the St. John's Wort one, by the way, they showed on the 29 clinical trials, some of those were placebo-controlled, and where people got a dummy pill. Some of those, the control group actually got a pharmaceutical drug that was actually an approved, FDA-approved antidepressant drug. And in most cases, the St. John's Wort was superior to placebo or was as effective as the pharmaceutical drug, with like 90% less adverse side effects than the pharmaceutical drug in treating the symptoms in patients with mild to moderate depression. So the evidence is very, very strong supporting St. John's Wort, as well as many, many other herbs. But what you hear is a few people out there keep saying, well, there's two clinical trials in the medical literature published in the United States that say the signs that St. John's Wort failed in a clinical study, and that's the one they keep banging the drum on, and they keep focusing on the high-profile negative trial, and they dismiss or totally are oblivious to so much of the other research that is reviewed by Cochrane and other systematic reviewers that continually to support, document, and in many cases confirm the safety and especially and the benefits of many of these products.
Okay, Mark, we're going to take just a couple-minute break right here on Progressive Radio Network. And when we come back, we're going to continue our discussion and look into how are popular people enjoying the use of these natural remedies? How is that growing in the U.S.? And we will be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
Radio Network, your voice for independent views.
This is Adam
Colker with Brooklyn Jazz Underground Radio. We'll be here every Tuesday from 5 to 6 with great music, interviews, and live performances. Right here on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network. Again, that's Tuesdays from 5 to 6, or you can listen anytime at the archives at progressiveradionetwork.com.
Join us, Bruce and Marianne Curtis, Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network for Truth and Freedom. We present provocative conversations with the world's most brilliant minds in the areas of holistic health, spiritual wisdom, politics, and a host of other topics. Some of our topics include the latest work in non-invasive therapy on the brain, the truth beneath the global economic meltdown, healing power of the breath, and the sublime truth beyond all religious traditions. In this age of transformation, we need to look beneath the surface appearance of things to see the underlying reality. For material that is always illuminating and often liberating, tune in to Truth and Freedom on the Progressive Radio Network Fridays at 3 p.m.
Is a state of emergency. No, it's not. It's more of a state of urgency. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your news dissector. I'm on the radio Fridays at 1 p.m. right here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, offering a different narrative to the news, challenging what we're hearing, what we're seeing, what we're reading, offering another way of understanding what's going on. Join me online on MediaChannel.org and join me here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com Fridays at 1 p.m. Be there or be square.
I'm Dr. Peter Breggin, author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness. Listen to my newly syndicated talk show, The Dr. Peter Breggin Hour, and find out why they call me the conscience of psychiatry. Hear my cutting-edge guests expose the dangers of conventional psychiatric diagnosis, drugs, and shock treatment. Learn about better ways, better therapeutic and spiritual approaches to healing ourselves and to making the most of our lives in a responsible, loving, and creative manner. Make your life turn out the way you want. Join me every 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, live or on the archive at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Progressive Radio Network, your home for progressive thinkers.
Thank you so much for listening once again to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We love to get your comments at Facebook, The Natural Nurse, or on the website, www.naturalnurse.com. And today we are interviewing Mark Blumenthal, the founder and executive director of the American Botanical Council, the leading independent nonprofit organization dedicated to disseminating accurate, reliable, and responsible information on herbs and medicinal plants. In addition, Mark is the editor-publisher of Herbalgram, an international peer-reviewed quarterly journal, and he has been a leader in the concerns for more rational regulations of herbal and natural product manufacturing, and, as you know if you've been listening to this show, education on natural medicines for more than 35 years. I strongly support you visiting the website, which is herbalgram.org, and there's just a plethora of information, a lot of it is extremely consumer friendly, just stuff that people can use to find out more about the true information about herbal medicine. And then there's a lot there for professionals as well, health professionals. He has excellent books such as the ABC Clinical Guide to Herbs and the Expanded Commission E-Monographs, and just on and on about the place to go for herbal medicine. So thank you again, Mark, for being our guest today.
Well, thank you. I'm very grateful for the opportunity.
Now, you know, I'm on the editorial board of Alternative Therapies in Health and Medicine,
mm-hmm.
as well as the Natural Standard Database, so I certainly have seen your writings there. And they are just so clear, well-written, and so well-referenced that I always use them myself as a to-go reference for things that I'm writing about herbal medicine.
Oh, excellent. Thank you for that.
Now, you also track the business of herbal medicine, which is important for
mm-hmm.
both manufacturers and consumers mm-hmm. alike.
Sure.
So what is that market looking like lately?
Well, it's good news. Last year in 2010, we published a report looking at 2009, the first full year of the so-called recession, and herb sales were up 4.8% in 2009 compared to 2008, the first full year of the recession. And then this year, we just published, and it's coming out this next week, our new report, so you're hearing it first now. Herb sales overall in 2010 were up 3.3% higher than 2009. So you have a 3.3% increase last year and a 4.8% increase the year before. What does this mean? At a time of the largest recession in recent memory in 70 years, the biggest consumer challenge for being able to spend money for food, for rent and or mortgages, you know, gas, car, transportation, health care, clothing, whatever, consumers are still buying not only dietary supplements, but they're increasing their purchases of herbal dietary supplements beyond what the previous year's sales figures have shown. This is a strong indicator of the continuing trend. It's not a fad. It hasn't been a fad for years because you and I, Ellen, for sure, since we were involved with this in the 70s when we first met, have watched the American public slowly but almost inexorably continue its interest in and fascination with and use of and then integration into the lifestyle of these products, so to the point that they're no longer considered alternative, but they're a part of our natural medicine, a natural holistic lifestyle, just like yoga, chiropractic, massage, and a lot of other things that used to be marginalized as alternative lifestyles, but today are just integrated into the standard, almost, you know, the standard American lifestyle.
So you guys track that sales data
and then
publish information so that people can know. Now, we have certainly seen that increase, and it's interesting, particularly with the downturn in the overall economic picture.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, you think that almost every other category of consumer goods faltered in 2008, 2009, 2010 because of the recession, higher gas prices in 2008, and other reasons why people were having to cut back on their expenses, on everything. And what we see happening is they're increasing on an overall level their purchases of herbs. Now, we understand, and our analysis showed this last year, that in 2009, our analysis last year showed that with the concern over H1N1, the swine flu epidemic, which never really materialized, fortunately, to the level that the World Health Organization and over here the Center for Disease Control were concerned about, people were nevertheless in anticipation of possibility of the H1N1 scare and ending up in a reality. People were buying more echinacea. Elderberry sales shot up 50% in health food stores. Other herbs that have a known or believed effect of being able to increase the immune system response so that people would have a little bit of an edge over trying to prevent the onset of a flu that might be of the H1N1 variety. People were not necessarily promoting echinacea and elderberry for H1N1, but consumers knew that these products have a cold flu benefit. They do improve immune system response based on some of the research that's out there. So consumers bought more of these products in 2009. Last year, in 2010, after the H1N1 concerns and scare abated significantly, and there was no prediction that it might be looming on the horizon, the sales of echinacea and elderberry and some of these other herbs actually came down significantly compared to 2009, where they were up because of the H1N1 scare. So, you know, there are some interesting sub-trends that we tease out, not just the macro 4.8 growth last the year before last, 3.3% growth this last year. We look at the macro, we try to look at the subtext as well and see what's going on, you know, underneath the surface.
Well, let's go in a little more deeply with any particular herb that you'd like to share information about, because every single month HerbalGram features specific herbs. Some are not that well known. Some, like you mentioned, echinacea, are very well known by many people. Chamomile tea, for instance, I would say has been used by mainstream people just as an herbal tea ongoingly, so they're never surprised about that one. But just any herb that you think listeners might like to know more about.
Well, I mentioned a few moments ago hibiscus as having documented in some systematic reviews of clinical trials, I think five trials to date, maybe six now, having a blood pressure lowering effect. The most recent trial was published at the beginning of 2010 at Tufts University. Dr. Jeffrey Blumberg and his group there actually tested a hibiscus tea. And the interesting thing here, this is not a concentrated extract that you find in a pill or tablet form that you find in the health food store or drugstore or grocery store or online. This is hibiscus tea, the famous ingredient you find in Red Zinger. You know, the famous tea that was like the one of the first the big items that Celestial Seasonings introduced around 1972. And hibiscus is actually not the flower. It's actually the covering of the flower of the hibiscus, of a certain type of hibiscus plant, very widely grown in Egypt and particularly Sudan. That's where a lot of our commercial hibiscus comes. It also comes from Caribbean, Southeast Asia, Mexico, et cetera. And the purpleness the redness of hibiscus tea comes from these compounds in hibiscus which are called anthocyanidins or proanthocyanidins, and these things are basically antioxidants, and they have the ability in this particular type of compounds, these red, purple, blue pigments, actually in the case of hibiscus, this particular variety or complement of these compounds actually can lower blood pressure in a very safe, mild, gentle manner. So if people have mildly elevated blood pressure, aside from changing their lifestyle and looking at some of their food habits and maybe increasing their mild exercise, you may want to consider taking hibiscus tea or taking some hibiscus supplements to help modify that blood pressure. And I'm not saying that people should do this necessarily if they have high blood pressure or seriously elevated blood pressure, which is a medically significant problem. But the research suggests that small elevations in blood pressure can possibly be adequately handled with some hibiscus tea. And who would have thought? And I'm not saying people should go out and do that. Talk to your doctor if you've got any questions about your blood pressure or any kind of potentially serious issue, but who would have thought a couple of years ago that hibiscus could be a contender in the blood pressure area? So what we're finding is that traditional herbs are sometimes having new uses that maybe we didn't know about before, and the science in some cases is actually strongly supporting those uses.
Yes, but I would say that you do a lot also. You're so multifaceted in your herbal knowledge and herbal reach. I know that you do trips to indigenous areas, and very often we will hear things like that from the indigenous healers with a tropical, a semi-tropical herb such as hibiscus, that they used it, although they may not discuss it in a medical sense, but they would say something like, you know, to calm down.
Right. And as a matter of fact, you're correct about that. If you look at some of the traditional ethnobotanical literature, blood pressure is actually, or hypertension, is actually listed as one of the traditional ethnobotanical uses in some cultures for hibiscus tea. So there is some traditional historical basis for what the modern research is basically supporting. But this is not something that we Western herbalists would have normally picked as one of our herbs of choice if we were looking at the possibility of choosing herbs that might have a mild hypotensive effect. I don't think 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, you or I, Ellen, if we were at a panel at a herb conference and somebody said, well, what herbs should I consider taking for a mildly elevated blood pressure? I don't think hibiscus would have been the top two or three that I would have picked.
That's right, and here we got a great study supporting that use. And you forgot to mention one thing, delicious.
Yes, especially, of course, the hibiscus teas often have lemon and orange in them and that kind of thing to moderate the flavor. It has kind of a dry flavor. It's not real sweet, but it's not sour either, although some people call it sour sop sometimes. But it has a delicious flavor that's, for some people, somewhat cultivated taste, but I like it.
Yeah.
And so do millions of others.
And it's tangy, and it's
all
a beautiful
over the world.
Color.
You know, in Sudan, it's called karkad, and one of the reasons they drink it in the summer is that they believe it helps lower their body temperature. I don't think anybody's ever done any research on that.
Right, but that's how it can feel, perhaps, you know, if the blood pressure is lowered a little bit. So it's interesting. Now, what do you think of cinnamon? Because there's been some very interesting research on something as commonly used as cinnamon.
Right. Well, the main research on cinnamon seems to suggest that cinnamon can have the ability to actually moderate high blood sugar levels, not blood pressure. A review article that recently came out didn't necessarily support this, but some of the individual clinical trials certainly seem to support a particular extract. I think it's called finulin, a certain proprietary extract. I'm not sure who the manufacturer that is. And actually having some blood sugar lowering effect or blood sugar moderating effect. And we see a number of common spices and herbs that have blood sugar beneficial effects. So there's some research in Canada on American ginseng in several studies, both in pre-diabetic and normal healthy people, that actually American ginseng extract or American ginseng capsules just made with the powdered root can actually moderate blood sugar spikes before or after a meal. And also fenugreek is one that's overlooked a lot, but fenugreek, which is a very popular herb in Asia and the Mideast, has a blood sugar moderating effect. And if you're not familiar with fenugreek, because it's not a major herb or a spice over here, your familiarity is probably based on the fact that fenugreek extract is the primary flavoring in imitation maple syrup. Imitation maple syrup is basically fenugreek extract with sugar and water, perhaps a few other flavors added, but that's the primary industrial use for these seeds that are grown quite by the in huge tonnages in India. Interesting stuff, fenugreek, something that's, I think, going to become more popular over here.
Something I found very fascinating about fenugreek, having written a lot and having experience with mothers who are nursing who use it, whether or not it's documented, but they tend to use it to help with mother's milk flow. But
correct.
Is that incorrect? But they do use it.
Oh, it's a traditional galactagogue, as you well know probably better than I, is one of the herbs of choice for increasing flow of breast milk.
It is, but something that has happened and has been documented is that the infant's urine may, in fact, have a maple syrup smell to it.
Yeah.
And doctors have gotten worried about this disease that's known as maple sugar disease when they were not knowledgeable about the use of fenugreek.
Yeah. It's probably a fairly intact metabolite of some of the compounds in fenugreek that give it its characteristic taste and fragrance, and why it's extracted and used for maple syrup. So, you know, Log Cabin or Aunt Jemima, if that's still in the marketplace, is basically fenugreek extract with sugar.
Right. Oh, I didn't even know that, because they don't list that on the label. That's why I love doing these shows. I always learn more. So they actually use fenugreek as a background for that maple sugar flavor.
Yes. It actually says imitation maple syrup on it, or imitation maple syrup flavor. I think legally they have to call it imitation maple syrup flavor, even though it's a natural herbal extract.
Oh.
So the word imitation has to be used because it's not true maple syrup, but it is. But you know, but it may or may not say made with a natural extract or not. I don't know.
And you also go around the world supporting, again, indigenous people with starting to learn how to recognize these plants that may have some commercial significance for them. And then the fact that if they are going to gather the plants, it's better to do it in a sustainable way so that you still have the crop the next year as a cash crop.
Exactly. Actually, to be frank with you, there's other organizations whose mission is much more focused on that thing, that activity you're talking about. We do support that. We support and have relationship with a number of organizations that do that kind of work and report on that. In our Herbalgram, we do a lot of conservation reporting. But yes, there are a number of organizations that are monitoring the sustainability of what we call MAPS, medicinal and aromatic plants, because aromatic mean plants that are basically either cultivated or wildly harvested for their aromatic, i.e. essential oil content, to make perfumes, soaps, cosmetics, that kind of thing.
Right, because if you think that it's worth something and then you just tear it all out, it's not going to be there the next year.
Well, particularly if the aromatic or the medicinal part that you're looking for is the root or the rhizome, which is the horizontal root, when you take that out, you basically kill the plant. So, you know, it could be sustainable if you're taking a fruit. It's sustainable if you're taking the seeds. It may be sustainable if you're cutting some of the leaves. But if you have to pull the plant out of the ground and take the root and kill the plant, then ultimately that's not sustainable, especially if these are wild plants, unless you just have an agreement based on what they call good collection practices and good agricultural practices, that you only take so much of the existing stand of that plant, and you take it, for example, in the case of wild American ginseng in the American East, east of the Mississippi primarily, you take my wild American ginseng only at certain times in August or late August or September after the plant has come and produced a fruit, which can be then replanted, or a seed that can be replanted so that you can sustain the ongoing generation of that population, that you don't take all the plants in a certain population, that you don't harvest plants from federal lands without a permit, etc., because there are not only harvesting requirements and sustainability issues. American ginseng is on the CITES list of threatened species. CITES is the Convention in Trade in Endangered Flora and Fauna, and that's an international group that the United States is a signatory to, and wild American ginseng has to be monitored carefully so that we don't do what the Chinese and Koreans did hundreds of years ago, which is pull it all out of the ground and have almost nothing left.
So we've seen this occur in history before.
We've seen it occur in history. We have. We've seen particularly China and Korea, with ginseng being such a highly valued herb for hundreds, if not thousands of years, they did not understand the long-term implications of pulling it out of the ground without reseeding it or regrowing it or breaking the root up and leaving some there. And what happened was they basically extirpated most of their wild populations. And so elated when they found out that the French, through the French missionaries in the early 1700s, around 1720, that there was this plant growing along the St. Lawrence River in the new part of the New World, later discovered further south of the St. Lawrence, but up in upstate New York and up in Canada, they found these plants that they sent over that the Chinese recognized as ginseng, although it's a different species of ginseng, has some of the same characteristics, sweet, bitter flavor, and they started trading in American ginseng as far back as 1720. And so that gave you the early colonies the most favored nation trading status with the Chinese, because we had shiploads of wild ginseng going from ports and harbors in New York over to China to sell to them for medicine. It came back with silks and porcelain and all that kind of stuff, but we sent them ginseng.
Yes, it was one of the first exported crops. So
exactly.
Quite interesting that we go back so far in time with this herbal medicine, and yet herbalgram.org brings it all together, the ancient history, the botanical pharmacology, the current science, and puts it together in a beautiful, beautiful magazine that I really think is great. If people don't like getting a whole magazine, you know, a lot of people don't like magazines anymore. They just want online. Well, it's available and searchable and just an excellent reference that you work so hard to put together, Mark. So I want to thank you for all those, that effort on the part of the plants and on the part of us herbalists.
Well, I appreciate that very much. I'm very grateful for your allowing me some time on your show, Ellen, and thank you for being such a strong supporter for natural medicine, for herbs, and thirdly, for being such a good supporter and loyal to the American Botanical Council and our unique nonprofit educational mission and programs. Very grateful to you.
Well, thank you so much. And would you say, Mark, that herbalgram.org is the best place to go to find out more?
Well, I don't know about the best because, you know, we're a nonprofit. We don't try to compete with people. We do the best that we can do. There are a lot of good places to get information on the Internet. Some of them you have to be careful for because they're often very commercial and not peer-reviewed. We are accurate. We're reliable. We're responsible. We're authoritative. And if that's best for you, then that's fine. It may or may not be. We're just trying to be honest here.
Right, but to find the American Botanical Council, I would say herbalgram.org is the best.
Well, that's
site.
You can say that. I won't.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for being our guest today, and thank you, listeners, for tuning in once again to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Until next week, this is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse. You can find us at Facebook, The Natural Nurse, or naturalnurse.com. And until next time, as always, we're hoping that you stay healthy.